Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care. Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors, close the blinds, change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, we're joined by James Bond director John Glenn. John directed 5 Bond films, starting from Pure Eyes Only and finishing with my favourite James Bond film, controversially for some people, License to Kill. On this interview, I'm joined by Scott from the excellent podcast Spy Hard. Scott, how are you?
I am very well, Chris. Thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasant and wonderful to finally be here.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have you on. It's been the other way around in the past, So it's nice to have you on here. So just for the benefit of the audience, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and Spy Hards?
Sure. Well, I'm one half of Spy Hards podcast. Basically, we're a spy movie podcast. I know you guys focus on more real life than most of the time than us. But we look at different spy movies throughout the entire history of spy movies, not just James Bond. We look at that certainly, but Jason Bourne, Mission Impossible, everything like that, all the way back to the silent era. Like, you'll see Buster Keaton films on there from time to time. Like, we really do run the gamut from when film started to now, looking at different spy movies.
Fantastic. Well, it's a great show, and I don't just say it because I've been on in the past, but it's a brilliant podcast, and I wish you all the best with that. So thank you for joining me on this interview today, because honestly, it wouldn't have happened without your help. So thank you for setting it up.
No, thank you for having me, and it was absolutely wonderful to go through this experience with you.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, let's go into our interview with John Glenn, and I'll catch you on the other side.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
So, John, welcome to the podcast, and thank you for having us over.
It's a pleasure.
It's good to have you on. So my first question, and I hope I'm right in this, am I right that you were in the RAF, your national service, before you went into filmmaking?
I was already in filmmaking. Yeah. I had to leave a film that I was working on when I got called up by the Air Force. And I was serving 18 months, and then the Korean War started.
Oh, wow.
This was 1950.
Yeah.
And suddenly, I was counting the days when I would get out, and then suddenly they put it up to 2 years. So I spent 2 years in the Air Force.
Oh, wow. And were you flying, or were you sort of ground staff?
No, I was ground staff. Yeah. And I finished up as a motor mechanic driver.
Yeah.
Which was another way of saying do nothing, basically. Which was, fortunately, it turned out to be quite fortuitous, because the film industry in England had one of the worst years ever while I was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends left the business altogether.
Mm.
And I was in a very junior capacity in the editing room when I got called up. And when I came back, it suddenly got busy again. That's what that's what happens in the film industry. Yeah. It's either all go or all stop.
Yes, know? Yes, I can relate to that. The reason why I brought the RAF, because quite one of the things I noticed about your James Bond films, there's a lot of aircraft involved. So I was wondering if there was some sort of flying passion that may have influenced that.
No. Funnily enough, the only reason I went in the Air Force really was because the uniform was better. Yeah. And also, I had two sisters who had been served in the RAF during the war, and I felt it gave me a bit of an in, you know, to get in there. I said, it's a family business sort of thing, and I was able to get into the RAF, and otherwise I'd have finished up square bash, you know, being in the infantry. I didn't fancy that at all.
Actually, years ago, John, in a previous life, I spoke to you about your role editing on Her Majesty's Secret Service. I interviewed you quite a time ago now. And sort of moving on from that, because obviously you spoke about being in filmmaking and doing your service and then going back to filmmaking. And if we're looking at sort of the Bond films here, when you got, I would say promoted, although I say both are equal part jobs, when you took your first job on as a director for James Bond, what was that process like for you? How did that come about, that sort of first 4 years only, as it were?
Yeah, well, it took a long time. I had to, first of all, establish myself in the editing world. And quite frankly, when I started, I didn't really know much. I didn't have a clue, really, quite honestly. I sort of stumbled through. But I spent many years, you know, I was on some great films, like The Third Man was one of my early films, and The Wooden Horse. Mm-hmm. Worked with some wonderful people. Funnily enough, one of the assistant editors on The Third Man was a chap called Bunny Warren. Obviously, they call him Bunny because his surname was Warren. But he was an assistant senior to me, and he taught me all the rudiments of being an assistant film editor. And many, many years later, when I eventually became a film director, I was going to a screening up in Water Street, mm-hmm. and a figure came stumbling along the road ahead of me. And as he came closer, I recognized it as Bunny Warren. And I said, Bunny, I said, and he stopped and looked at me and he said, John, haven't you done well? And I almost cried. It was strange, really. It was just, you know, this is a chap that had served in the Fleet Air Arm during the war. And, you know, they were on pills all the time to keep them when they were flying and what have you. So he was very slow in the way he walked. That's how I recognized him, by his walk, really, as he came towards me. And what a wonderful person, and taught me a lot in the early days. And he was generally pleased that I'd gone on so well, you know. But the actual process of becoming an editor is a long, drawn-out thing, and it's a very artistic and extremely important job in films, the editing side. And you don't learn it overnight. It takes a while. You've got to throw, in those days, of course, there was a lot of technical stuff, which you don't have today. For younger people going into editing, it's all about pushing buttons, whereas in my day, you had this terrible spaghetti to work with, film. And it was difficult to handle. You had to learn how to handle it, and you had to work quickly. I tell you, it was a very, very quickly, fast process. Working on the Wooden Horse, I always remember there was a screening for the great man, Sir Alexander Calder, up in 146 Piccadilly, which was his head office. And I remember we were all rushing, it was all hands to the pump to get the film ready to show to the great man. We were working at Shepperton Studios, and the car was waiting, and I was in there frantically joining film together. And I managed to join a piece, you know, it was all put together with paper clips, and I was working so quickly a piece fell out, and I managed to join it in upside down. So halfway through the screening, the image was inverted, and everyone turned around and glowered at me, you know. I was at the back of the theatre at 146 Piccadilly, and suddenly the great man, Sir Alexander Calder, suddenly lifts his hands up and makes a gesture that he wanted something lifted. And everyone was a bit puzzled, and they assumed it was the sound. So they turned round to me and said, "Put the sound up." And I had a control which said raise and lower. So I wasn't familiar with the theatre, so I saw raise, so I hit this button, nothing happened, I hit it again, and suddenly the lights all went up in the theatre and the curtains drew on the film halfway through, and they all scrambled all over me and reversed the process and got the thing going again. And Sir Alexander Calder just sat there, whether he was asleep or not, I don't know, but he didn't worry about it at all. And because I was only about 15 or 16, I got away with it.
I imagine you sunk quite low in your seat at that. When the bit came upside down, you just, oh, no, that wasn't me.
Well, there you go. But it's a lesson again. Everything's a lesson in life. And, you know, when you do things in a panic and you're rushing and everyone's rushing, you've got to make time for yourself. Otherwise, you know, disasters happen.
And, you know, the part of the film being upside down, it's just avant-garde. It's just, yeah. You're just pushing the limits of cinema.
He didn't react to it. Everyone glowered at me, you know. But you make a lot of mistakes when you're young. And you, funny enough, I feel sorry for a lot of the people today. They go to school until they're in their late 20s. And people don't forgive the mistakes quite like they forgive a 15 or 16-year-old, you know. So there's a lot to be said for starting young in a business, really. I think there's probably too much education today.
And making mistakes. It's very important because you don't learn otherwise.
But you need to make mistakes when you're young. And get away with it. But when you get older, you make mistakes, can be a disaster.
Well, you speak about sort of learning your tropes, learning your game with editing, and you speak about the third man, speak about On Her Majesty's Secret Service, things that you worked on there. But getting that job as the director for For Your Eyes Only, what did you do to prepare from sort of that jump from editing and second unit directing to directing a full feature film?
Well, I was very fortunate because I saw the beginning of television, series, TV series, like Danger Man was one of the films that I was editing on. And we had a producer called Sidney Cole. He used to be a film editor as well. He was a very good producer. He gave me the opportunity to do second unit work on the TV series because the schedules were so tight. And, you know, on a film like Danger Man, there's lots of inserts, like little miniature tape recorders, which was a Philly Shave razor, which had been adapted to record. And so all those little tight shots take ages to light and to get done properly. And I would ring Central Casting to get an actor down to do the hand work on the, you know, to double for Patrick McGoohan's hands. And they always sent someone down who was about 75 years of age and been sort of just desperate for a bit of work and had the shakes, you know. So, you know, when you've got a pack lens on the camera and you're that close, you know, if you got a shaky hand, you're in a lot of trouble. Mm. So I used to say, why don't you sit there and have a cup of tea? And I used to get in there and do it myself, which was fine with the union because, you know, at least you're still employing the chap. So I was able to do so. All those little inserts I used to do myself.
See, so Patrick McGoohan's hand is brilliant.
Yeah. Well, I was young and I hadn't got the shakes, at least not then. But no, that was all good experience doing all those inserts. And then gradually, I moved on to doing some action sequences, you know, car run-by. I started off with car run-bys and things. And when we were working at Pinewood Studios, there's a little crossroads quite adjacent to the studio. And there's like three or four, I think there's three roads all come in, and there's a little island in the middle with some shrubbery and tree. And I used to set the camera up there. And I would do about 8 different shots of the car running by without moving the camera more than 2 feet, purely to keep the schedule because, you know, I had so much to do in such a short space of time. And, you know, if you'd gone over, you would never get asked again. So it was very important to be quick. So it's, you know, you can change a shot just by, you know, putting what we used to call a dingleberry in the foreground, a couple of leaves in the foreground. It looks like a different shot, mm-hmm. a different place, whereas in fact it's the same shot that you've done previously. So you learn all those tricks, you know, shortcuts. And I learned how to, you know, I had good ideas, I suppose. And I learned how to do run-bys and make them dramatic and what have you. Mm. And then gradually you get more and more important work as the producers see that you know what you're doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I was editing and finding time to do those shots. Mm-hmm. And I used to use my assistants. I used to delegate. I'd say, you know, get on and join those few shots together. And then when I came back from doing my second unit, I come back, look at what they've done. And I said, what did you do that for? You know, so, you know, think dramatic. And gradually, these chaps who were my assistants all became editors, because the only way you learn is by actually doing the job. Mm-hmm. You can have all the theory in the world. It helps you, but it doesn't, you know, at the end of the day, you've got to be able to handle the film. But today it's different. It's a completely different thing because you're all on electronics now. It's all push button. So I think it was just as well that I went on to become a director, because I don't think I could handle the stuff today, honestly.
Well, you said your first Bond film was For Your Eyes Only. What was that like, moving from editor to being director in that movie? Because that's a big responsibility. What was that like, and how did you prepare?
I was very, very fortunate in the fact that I'd edited 3 Bond films prior to that. So I was very familiar with all the crew and the cast and the producers. Roger Moore, of course, was a great benefit. He was such a pro. Never fluffed a line. I mean, I don't know how he did it. I did ask him one day. He said, oh, it's a technique you learn, you know, as an actor. But he was always there, and sometimes... You know, we'd choose a lady in a scene for her beauty and her, you know, her looks. She probably wasn't a very good actress at all. So, you know, you do about 8 or 9 takes on this actress, and Roger was feeding her the lines off screen, and I used to feel for him a bit because he was always take 1, take 2, done, you know. He was so professional, but he was very patient with everyone. And very professional, very good director himself, actually.
Were there any sort of influences for you with For Your Eyes Only? Because it's obviously quite a, for Roger, it's quite a dramatic film. And in many ways, I felt like there's some similarities with what you did later with License to Kill. But with For Your Eyes Only, was there anything that was sort of driving you in that direction to sort of make it more dramatic and, should we say, more grounded?
Well, Spy Who Loved Me was... When I came back in the fold with Lewis Gilbert, I was working with Lewis Gilbert in Paris on another film, 7 Nights in Japan, it was called. And Thelma McConnell was the editor, and she got sick on the film. And in fact, she died on the film. And on her deathbed, she whispered to Lewis Gilbert, get John Glenn, because I'd worked with Thelma on TV series For Just Men many years before. And I always remember there were 2 sound editors. I was a sound editor at that time. And there were 2 of us. And she at the end of the thing, there was only room for 1 person to stay. And she called me into her office and she said, John, dear John, so I know that when you leave here, you'll get another job straight away, he said, but the other chap, Freddie, will struggle. So do you mind leaving first so he can have a few more weeks' work? And I said, sure. And she was paying me back for that all those years later.
Yeah.
So it was quite amazing. I was almost willed to Lewis Gilbert, although I had worked with Lewis previously as a sound editor. The Admirable Crichton and Cry from the Streets. I was sound editor with Lewis. And when he called me to offer me the job in Paris, he said, oh, you're that tall, lean chap, aren't you? And I said, well, I'm not so lean anymore.
Well, you mentioned Chris Brenchen's License to Kill. I know you wanted to get to that in a minute, but just on For Your Eyes Only, because it's actually one of my favourite of the Bond films, because I prefer the more sort of serious-toned Bond films. They're from Russia with Loves, those sort of things, all up to the Craig films now. And that's why I always go to For Your Eyes Only when it comes to Roger Moore. When it comes to the tone of that film, obviously it's quite a shift from what came before. I think Moonraker previously, that's a very different tonal film to For Your Eyes Only. Was that a conscious effort from Broccoli and from above to make it that? Or was that something that you sort of injected yourself?
Well, I mean, Roger was not supposed to do that film. He was in the middle of negotiations with Cubby Broccoli, and he was out of contract, and my first task was to find a new James Bond. I always remember Cubby said, "We've got to find a new guy because Roger's not doing it anymore. He was getting too expensive," and they were haggling, you know. And I, like a fool, believed every word of it. And I went out and I went all over the world testing Australian actors, American actors, you name it. And eventually, at the end of the day, it was a poker game between Cubby and Roger, because they were both quite shrewd guys when it came to money. And so it was an effort to keep his money within bounds, shall we say. And eventually, of course, Roger agreed to do it. He kind of resented me initially, because although I'd worked with Roger on about 5 films up to that point, in fact, he turned around one day and said, "Am I in your contract or are you in mine?" But he took it very well in the end. But he'd heard that, of course, I was testing. That was the whole point of the thing. I was testing other actors. And initially, it was a bit sort of frosty the first couple of days. But Roger couldn't hold a grudge for long. And, we were very good friends. And we had a wonderful working relationship. But to answer your question, my instructions were to make the series more earthy after Moonraker, which had gone into space and all that and gone a little bit silly, I think. And I had to bring the series down to earth. And we had one or two notable moments on that film where Roger and I kind of disagreed about what he should do. And I think that was the main one, was when he pushed the car off the cliff. And Roger wanted the weight of the little flag emblem, the dove emblem, to be the counterbalance that sent the car hurtling to, with Locke in the villain in the car, to his death. And I said, "No, Roger, I think that he killed your best friend on the film. I said, I think you would kick that car off the cliff, not just be too subtle about it." And we had quite a discussion about it. And it was a pivotal turning point, I think, in the way Roger played in the film. And although he had lots of fun and there were lots of laughs and things, and he's quite lighthearted, it was a moment of high drama. And after we shot it both ways, I mean, I said, "Okay, we'll try it your way, but then I want you to do it my way." And he readily agreed. And at the end, I did both. He tossed the dove emblem in and then kicked the car off the cliff. And afterwards, Roger turned around and admitted that was the right decision.
Yeah, it's a very dramatic point. And I think it leads nicely into the tone of License to Kill. So before we go into License to Kill, what was the transition from Roger to sort of Timothy Dalton like? You know, because you're bringing in a new actor to portray Bond, and I know you'd already been on this sort of quest earlier, but what was it like now handling this official transition that's happening?
Well, it's always a tremendous gamble, I think, when you change your Bond actor. You know, there aren't that many. It's a kind of strange role, really. You need a physically attractive specimen of a man. At the same time, you need someone who's a good actor, but doesn't have to be a Shakespearean actor like Timothy Dalton was. Today, I think there's quite a number of actors who could probably play James Bond, but at that time, there seemed to be a bit of a dearth of that type of actor. And I remember when I was in Los Angeles with Cubby and we were discussing this, and I said to him, "What about Timothy Dalton?" Because we had considered him in the past when he was young, after he did Lion in Winter. They considered him. He was very young then, very good actor. And he wasn't really interested in playing James Bond at that time. But times move on, and now, like 15 years later, or whatever it was, he was more, you know, in tune with taking that part. But he wanted to bring his own brand of personality to the role. And we discussed it at length, and we agreed that we would use his acting ability, which was considerable, to put a harder edge on the Bond, more in the sort of Fleming style thing which he originally wrote. So we were going back to the roots of Bond, really. And Timothy, he I remember a couple of times on the set, on the first film, you know, he liked to put his hands in his pockets and things like that. And I took him to one side and I said, "Yeah, Tim, don't put your hands in your pocket." I said, "You know, Bond was a naval officer. He would have, it would be ingrained in him not to do that," and things like that. And I don't think Tim necessarily agreed with me, but he went along with it. But, you know, he got stupid little games like, you know, off on the side of camera, I couldn't see he'd have a hand in his pocket, you know, things like that. So, yeah, you accept certain things, you. But, you know, I didn't want him to be, you know, Bond is always immaculately dressed, you know, with every occasion. And it's part of the character. So I was very insistent, but...
I think he has the best James Bond introduction in the whole series. That whole Gibraltar sequence is brilliant.
Yeah.
Did the... Because I know Timothy kind of came in quite sort of late to the process. Did him coming in affect the script for The Living Daylights?
Yeah, well, we hardened him. You see, we'd run out of Fleming stories, actually, and we were using short stories and titles. And Michael Wilson and Richard Maybaum... you know, had to really invent these stories to a large degree, although we did go back into the history of Bond and use some of the sequences which hadn't been filmed, which were in the books, some of the original books, like the, for instance, in the Greek thing about the underwater stuff, which had been in an earlier book and not been used. For what reason it wasn't used, I don't know. But, I mean, there's so much material, action material, in the Fleming books. And they made great use of them in the past. Yeah, so, you know, we actually more or less had to construct a whole... We used on For Your Eyes Only, we used a short story, which was called For Your Eyes Only. But it only occupied probably about 10 minutes of the film. And it's a very good scene, I must say. It's original Fleming, and it's beautifully played by Roger and Carole Bouquet, who's a very, very beautiful French girl. Funnily enough, there was Roger used to query some of my action ideas, and when he escaped from the mob by the swimming pool in that film, that I said to him, take one of these beach umbrellas and use it to cushion your fall when you leap 18 feet off the top of the balcony onto the ground below to escape. And eyebrows were lifted, as you can imagine, when I suggested that. But, you know, same thing when I said on the Octopus, we rode him into the circus and he had to wear a clown's outfit. He said, "Joe, you can't be serious." Me dressed up as a clown, but it was a perfect disguise, you know.
It's actually one of the most serious parts of that film, despite the costume. You know,
yeah, exactly.
What's going on in the background of that?
So like it was like a counterpoint. That's what I loved about it. You know, it was unexpected. Even dressing him up in a gorilla's outfit in the train, you know, they're searching for him in this carriage, and it's all the costumes are there. Then you pan onto the ape monkey's costume, and there's Roger's eyes turning. You know, oh, the lovely moment, you know, and the audience loved it.
Yeah.
You know, it's again counterpoint. You're in a very dramatic situation, and then you throw in a bit of humour.
It's what Bond does best, I find. That's that being able to switch between those two moments within a film. It's something that I think Bond films do
it
very
is
well.
Very much Bond, isn't it? Tongue in cheek.
One moment in that transition phase that Chris was talking about between having Dalton join the production for Living Daylights and License to Kill, there is a brief moment in time, and there's a couple of photos of you with Pierce Brosnan, where Pierce was going to be Bond for that film.
I shot the test for Pierce, and he was very good. Mm-hmm. It was just that he was under contract with Mary Tyler Moore for Remington Steele. And when she heard that we were going to use him as Bond, of course, she enacted his contract and wanted to continue her series. But that was not... Cubby Broccoli wasn't going to have that. So he was put to one side, shall we say, for a few years. And actually, it was a good thing because he was very good in it, Pierce. Made a very good Bond. More in the Roger Moore mold, I felt. Mm. You know, he wasn't a heavy Bond. He was light, like Roger was, you know, a lot of humour.
Yeah. And All's Well definitely ended well when it came to Pierce, you know, when he came back in 95 with Goldeneye. I mean, that's a triumph in many ways. It's the reason I'm a Bond fan. It brought me into the fold as a child. But, you know, it's interesting to see that sort of transition with Pierce. How long was he part of the production for until you lost him?
Well, we did the tests, and they were very, very good. And we sent them out to America, and they approved him as Bond. And we came back, and we celebrated. We had dinner at the White Elephant with Cubby and Pierce and had a celebratory lunch. And the phone rang, and Pinewood Studios was on fire. Our 007 stage was alight. Ridley Scott was doing a film there, and during the lunch hour, the set caught fire and it burnt the stage down. You wouldn't believe it. A stage made of steel and concrete and was just rubble. And then, of course, the Mary Tyler Moore thing came up, and Pierce had to go by his contract. He'd signed an open contract with her, and therefore it precluded him from taking the part, really. But, you know, all these things, that's when Timothy entered the fray. And I always remember we had dinner at Michael Wilson's place with Timothy, and we discussed it, and we agreed that he would become a more serious Bond of the Fleming type. It didn't mean that he wouldn't have the humour, but, you know, we'd try and really make use of his acting ability. And I think we succeeded. Mm.
I think in some ways those films are a little bit ahead of their time, because I think the Daniel Craig films are very much in that vein now.
Yeah. Well, that's the great thing about Bond. The actors, whichever actor you choose, you have to sort of say, what are their strong points, and take full advantage of it. It's a sensible approach. I think probably when Roger Moore took over from Sean Connery, shall we say, the first couple of films, he didn't really stamp his own personality on the part. He must have had like one foot in the Sean Connery camp and one foot in his own personality. And Roger had lots of personality, believe me. And I think once Spy Who Loved Me was a very good film, and I think that was when Roger really cemented the part, you know. Mm. And from then on in, that's, you know, he made the part his own.
Yeah.
He was very successful as Bond.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break and then we'll be right back. You mentioned earlier, obviously, they were running out of Fleming novels to adapt. And one thing I noticed about the two Dalton films, Living Daylights and License to Kill, they did have a feeling of being on the pulse of current events. Because in 1985, you had something called The Year of the Spy, where there were so many defections going on in the real world, and famously Oleg Gordievsky. And then with License to Kill, you've got sort of this drug baron Sanchez. And I was wondering if you had any insight and just sort of... what the inspiration for those sort of two topics were, really, in those films.
I suppose, you know, when we look back on that time, you're right. It was the era of the spies. You know, I can always remember the chap who was killed with an umbrella which had a poison tip on it on London Bridge. Mm. It sounds far-fetched, doesn't it? Mm. But, you know, people were assassinated in ingenious ways, and it was almost like a James Bond film. Mm. Things change, you know, the styles change. I think that in a way, there was far more meat for a Bond story in those days than there probably is today. Mm. It gets more and more difficult, actually, to fit Bond into the present day. You want to see Bond actually doing a hand-to-hand stuff with in action. I think the electronics and that are so sophisticated now that they're taking a lot of the fun out of making movies. You know, there are, you have to scratch your brain a bit to do something original. But, you know, we always did very good things on trains, for instance. Mm. You know, we've had some wonderful, I mean, for Russia with Love, you know, the big scene on the train there. There's always a fight and very sophisticated dialogue. You know, how did you know I was who I said I was? And he said, well, you ordered something or some wine, the wrong wine with your meal. What's that? So, you know, so it was very clever dialogue, really. Yeah. And of course, Robert Shaw was a wonderful adversary to Bond. Mm. He would have made a wonderful Bond, Robert Shaw. But there you go. Yeah, so times change and you have to change with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we used to write the scripts. I mean, we took a big chance with the drug thing on License to Kill because, I mean, you know, it is a terribly hard, harsh, cruel business. And they kill the people, they kill their families, they kill everybody. They're a ruthless lot. Kind of a bit hard to make a Bond movie with that background, and we did take a risk. And I mean, you look at License to Kill now, I mean, it's far more acceptable now than it was when we made it, I think. Yeah. But we tried to be realistic and honest about it. And yeah, it's a good film. I'm very proud of it.
I think it holds up very well. I saw it last year at the Prince Charles Cinema. I can't remember if you were there, Scott, but just watching it on the big screen. And one of the big things I appreciate, I'm sort of transitioning a bit into the technical side of things now, but were the practical stunts that you use. Because obviously today we use a lot of computer-generated technology that I find just takes the believability out of sequences, and you've got this spectacular stuff with aircraft. You've got that amazing tanker chase. And I suppose I'm really fascinated by A, what inspired those sort of sequences, and B, how did you go about sort of doing them? Because especially the aircraft stuff and the tanker.
Yeah, I mean, the aeroplane, for instance, we flew it over via the particular plane we found in America, and we flew it over via Iceland. It had a limited range, you know, and then flew on to Denham Airfield. And then in the field opposite the studio, Pinewood, there was a farmer's field with a fence in the centre and a hedge. And with the farmer's permission, we bulldozed his hedge down enough for the plane to land. And we actually flew it from Denham and landed it actually just outside the studio.
Yeah.
And we took it to pieces and put it on the set and did all our close shots on the set.
And was that the plane for Living Daylights, that plane? Or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the Hercules sequence. That's brilliant.
No, the Hercules, we didn't put the Hercules down the field. It would, that wouldn't have worked.
No.
It was the one. It was the one in India where they were on the outside of the aeroplane having a fight on the outside of the aeroplane.
Yeah. The Twin Beach, I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a beach aircraft. Yeah. You know, Peter Lamont, who unfortunately died a couple of years ago, was a superb designer, and nothing was a problem. You know, on the train sequence, we had a move-in back-in, which we laid. So it was horizontal, and we had a crane. We lifted the locomotive over the top of this moving back in, and we painted railway lines on the back in. And that's how we did all that close shot of Roger underneath the train having a fight and being hacked at by the Indian adversary who had a sword and was severed the pipes of the air pipes. And it was a very exciting scene, actually.
Yeah.
And we had this sort of 20-ton locomotive hanging over the top of Bond, and we played that scene there with this moving backing, which we used quite a lot in films. You know, projection, rear projection is very good for certain scenes.
Yeah, yeah.
but you do lose quality. So we used to avoid that wherever possible. Yeah, so if we could use a moving backing, it was better for the photography than using front projection or rear projection.
Yeah, got you. I think with License to Kill, it didn't seem there was so much rear projection, especially it's that tanker sequence. Quite a lot's going on. You've got this moment where Timothy Dalton's jumping from the crop duster plane to the tanker itself. Then he's getting shot at. It's all sorts of things kind of going on. How did you sort of break those bits up? Because there's quite a lot of moving parts there.
I spent about a week down at Mexicali in Mexico, shooting all the main actors, Roger and so forth. Timothy's brother, what am I talking about, Roger? Timothy, doing the close shots and so forth. So I did the minimum that I could do there. And Arthur Worcester, who again is departed, I'm afraid, who was a wonderful second unit director and cameraman. Again, the art of delegation. Yeah. You pick these people and they're fantastic. And he must have spent a month down there with Barbara Broccoli. She was producing that part of it. And it's an incredible scene, that truck sequence. Mm. And it was very dangerous. Yeah. And a lot of that stuff we did with doubles. Mm. And, you know, the slightest slip, they fell down. You got, 16 wheels on every truck. It'd be very difficult to miss anyone. But fortunately, we had a few accidents, but nothing serious, too serious. Mm. But those trucks were very unforgiving. Mm. And when you're dealing with those moving things, most of it was done for real, I must tell you. But
There's one shot that pops in my head where I think it's after the rocket's been fired at Timothy. I think the truck's blown up, and then the car that was chasing him is now on fire and kind of goes off a cliff, and it just narrowly avoids Pam in the plane. It's like it's been fired off. How do you get the timing of those things?
Exactly. It was difficult. Well, I was a bit scared on that one, that John Richardson, who was our special effects supervisor, is an absolute wizard. We made a scaled down version of the car. He constructed it like a third size.
Yeah.
And he fired it out of an air cannon.
Yeah.
And Corky Fornoff, who was the pilot of the aeroplane, he was a bit worried. He said, so I said, we'll shoot it in such a way that it will look a lot closer to hitting your aeroplane, but hopefully it won't. But John couldn't test it, really, because it would have destroyed the actual mock-up car. So he just worked it out, and he's very clever. And we just did one take of it, and it was fine. Mm. It was good.
Yeah, it looks really good.
But we used a similar thing on Octopussy when the locomotive hits the car, and the car nearly takes the fisherman down in the Neen River down below. And that was tight. That was really tight. That did actually hit the boat. And these two or three stuntmen who were supposed to be fishermen would really jump for their lives, I tell you.
Oh, my goodness. Doing it for real definitely makes it look good. And I suppose it looks even better when people actually are running for their lives. But I don't think we'd get away with that these days, would we?
Probably not. I'm sure there's too many health and safety check boxes we need to do to get these sorts of things done now. But I was just sort of maybe wrapping up the stunt side of things for it. But one thing I always say about your films, John, is you know how to do action. All of your films, the action is tremendous, and you can just watch it and be wowed about what you see on the screen. So maybe more of a general question for all the films that you worked on as a director. What do you think makes a good action sequence, and how did you get that in your films?
Well, you plan it. You draw it all up. I'm the world's worst artist, but I used to do my own little storyboards, little stick insects and arrows and instructions. And then I'd employ good artists come in, sometimes two at the same time. And they would then embellish my drawings. And I used to look at their storyboards after they use mine as a guide, but, you know, then they confer with me every now and again. And say, did you mean this and all that? And Roger Deer was a very good artist, and he used to draw his storyboards sometimes outside the frame. You know, he would extend the storyboard so it was outside the little square of the frame.
Sure.
And he was brilliant. And when they were so good, his drawings from my terrible drawings, that it used to inspire people. I used to post them all around the room in my office, all these sequences. Like the truck sequence was a huge sequence. It was about, I don't know, 25 minutes long in the film. You know, it occupied the whole of my office, all the drawings. So it's all planned. And on a bomb film, sometimes we'd have four units shooting the same scene. I would concentrate. I used to do the second unit, so, you know, I'm very familiar with how it all works. But you'd have an underwater sequence. So you'd have specialist underwater cameramen and so forth. And in fact, on For Your Eyes Only, we were filming the top side of the chase, the scene where the villain's trying to drown Roger and the girl, and they're tied together. I was doing the stuff on the surface at exactly the same time that our underwater camera crew were out in the Bahamas shooting what was going on underneath. And it's planning, you know, and I loved it. Just the planning, these actions, they were all drawn. Everyone knew what they were doing. And the beauty of it is that a lot of directors won't delegate. With action, you have to delegate because otherwise you'd never do it. You'd run out of time. And the second, third, fourth units can do it again and again. I can see the rushes and say, no, it's not, I have to have another go, you know. And it doesn't cost a fortune. But on the first unit, you're dealing with the actors, you know, thousands of pounds a minute. You know, time is precious and you can't go behind schedule. Otherwise, it just throws, I mean, you're shooting for 6 months. You can imagine the overages if you start going out of schedule, and you hire actors for certain scenes for certain days. But if you get out of sync with that, it can be very expensive.
I can hear the dollar signs just rattling up in the background.
But you have to be aware of that.
You share that trait then with Alfred Hitchcock, because he famously drew out almost every single moment of every single film he ever did meticulously. And that's why he's such a visually dynamic filmmaker.
Yeah, well, you buy time, you see. If you're sensible and you know your limitations, you know what you can do and what you can't do, and you pick your own crew, and you pick great aerial cameramen like B.J. Worth. You know, wonderful guys to work with. Young, inexperienced in film, but wonderful what they do. And, you know, I did Moonraker, the pre-title sequence on Moonraker out in California. We go to California because the weather's better, frankly. You try and shoot an aerial sequence in England, you could be there for 6 months before you got the nice blue skies, and they got quite a different attitude there. With aeroplanes are like easy to work with in America. So we used to do a lot of air aerial stuff in America. And I was out in the Napa Valley for about 3 weeks on Moonraker, and I'd drawn it all up. And I was being an editor as well. I was editing my materials. I went along as I was shooting each 2 second segment of the airborne chase, airborne fight.
Yeah.
The concept of, you know, Roger being pushed out of a plane without a parachute, has to catch up with a guy who's already jumped, who has a parachute, wrestle the parachute away from him, put it on, and then he gets hit by Jaws. It sounds simple, doesn't it?
But it's not.
Very general question. What do you think are the essential ingredients of a good Bond film?
Well, action's very important, extremely important. The stories are don't have to be that strong, but they need to be simple, understandable. You've got to have the humour. It's a special kind of humour. Tongue-in-cheek, you know, is essential on a Bond. It's a delicate balance. I mean, some people probably look at my films and think maybe I went a little bit too comic on some of the stuff. I mean, I was probably influenced by the Keystone Cops and all those early things I saw when I was a kid, you know, as kids' cinema. I used to go to the Astoria at Ashford on Saturday morning. I really looked forward to it. I think that's probably where my creativity in terms of action came from. All full of kids and, you know, daring dudes going on the screen, and And I seem to remember all that stuff. You know, it's strange, isn't it? It just sinks into your subconscious. And but I guess I was pretty good at action because I was an editor and I could visualize action in small segments. You know, you think of a simple thing, and maybe there's a car crash and someone gets thrown out and someone dies and someone does this and does that. But you've got to break it down into easy-to-film segments. Don't try and do too much in one, if you follow me. Otherwise, it'll all go wrong. It's complicated, and there is a safety aspect to it. You know, if you're doing a dangerous stunt. I mean, probably my most famous scene is the ski parachute jump in Spy Who Loved Me. It was the first thing we ever shot on Spy Who Loved Me. And I was working with Lewis in Paris, Lewis Gilbert. He came in, he said, I've got to have lunch with Cubby Broccoli today. He's just flown in from America. So he went off and had lunch with Cubby. And when he came back, he said, oh, Cubby's very keen for you to do some of the action shooting on the movie. You know, he was praising you for the work you did on the Majesty's Secret Service and what have you. And, you know, the bobsleigh sequence principally, which Cubby and I both enjoy going down on the bobsleigh run. And he said, we've got to find something for John to do. Well, the problem was I was finishing with Lewis and there was a three-month gap before the film was going to start. So they got to write it all and everything, you know, it's at least 3 months. So he talked to Cubby about it and he came back and he said, well, don't worry, we'll find you something to do. And that something to do was to do that pre-title sequence with Rick Sylvester.
Just that little sequence that everyone loves and is one of the best
episodes. I mean, that cost us, Lewis said afterwards, he said that sequence cost as much as one of my feature films cost, you know, on one of his early films. Like, I mean, one of his best films was the film with Michael Caine, Elfie.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. One of my favourite films. I just love it. Lewis is a very simple director, very easy to work with. You know what you're doing, boy. Get on with it, sort of thing. That was his. So I can remember him saying that to me. Yeah, he gave you some rough outline of what he wanted, and he said, "Go on, you get on with it." And you know, he gave you a lot of freedom. You learn from them. He was a master filmmaker, and one of the most prolific directors we've ever had in this country. Terrific.
That just sparks your imagination, doesn't it, though? Because they give you the sort of freedom to go and do it, and you have to then envision it and create something.
That's right.
That also allows you to grow.
Mean, you know, you plan these things. I mean, the whole essence of the Bond action scenes is they were planned. Mm-hmm. Certainly in my day, though, you know, you have to storyboard it, because otherwise everyone has their own interpretation of. And you allow them a certain, you know, you allow them a certain latitude on when they do it. You know, Arthur Worcester would telephone me in the middle of somewhere and say, oh, it's not working because of so-and-so. And I'd quickly say, well, change it to whatever. Yeah, fine, go ahead, change it, and I'll sort it out. You can't really swim against the tide sometimes. You have to go with it.
Know your strengths and play to them, I say. Well, one thing I wanted to ask, and sort of bouncing off of Chris's question a little bit, was baddies. One thing I always say, again, apart from action with your films, is you do some fantastic villains. I recently spoke with Robert Davi, and he did nothing but praise your direction in the film and said you remain one of the best directors he's ever worked with. And I wanted to sort of throw that comment and that sort of to you and ask, what do you think makes a good villain? Because I think you made several great villains.
Oh, I think you know, they have to be almost as equal to Bond. I think that's the secret, that they are an adversary that is their equal, so they have to pit their wits against each other. And you're always looking for that. And Robert Davi was a brilliant villain. In fact, we dressed him up. We were testing some girls for various parts in Hollywood, and we dressed Robert up in his tuxedo, and he played Bond for the tests, and he was brilliant as Bond. He was a rugged Bond, you know, and I mean, Robert is handsome in a rugged way. He's like your typical hoodlum, if you like, in terms of mafia type you would use in a film. He's perfect, you know, Al Capone or someone like that. Sure. It would be terrific, you know. But he was also handsome in a very rugged way and very masculine, very tough, and a pleasure to work with, very professional.
For the sort of looking at your cavalcade of baddies, even like Christopher Walken, someone you work with in A View to a Kill, is it the casting that gets the best villain, or is it coming from the script, or is it a combination of the both? Where do you think that magic comes from?
Well, it's very much a compilation job, really. Mm. I mean, you know, you write, you have a vision of a villain, shall we say.
Sure.
And then you cast your net around, and who's available, who will do it, you know, who's affordable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Marlon Brando I worked with on Christopher Columbus, mm-hmm. you know. I was terrified. He was very lately, you know, he was cast at the last minute, if you like. And his children were up on murder charges. And he said to me, he said, I'm only doing this film to pay the lawyer's fees. But what a charming man. He was the exact opposite of what I expected.
Mm-hmm.
I trembled when I thought, I'm dealing with this, probably the greatest screen actor there's ever been, you know. And that's saying something, isn't it? But he turned out to be absolutely charming. You know, it was towards the end of his career, so maybe it mellowed a bit, but I just found him so cooperative and so easy and so talented. He used to use a voice thing like a hearing aid,
mm-hmm.
and the lines were relayed from another room into his ear by a little radio. I didn't realize that initially. And I kept saying, I think you just speed that scene up a bit on that, because he was pausing while he heard the stuff coming from next door.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd reached that stage in his life where he couldn't remember, or he didn't want to remember too much. Mm-hmm. And he took the, yeah, he was clever. But it worked. It was magic on the screen. Mm-hmm.
Well, John, I think unfortunately we'll probably have to wrap up, but thank you so much for your time today. It's been wonderful chatting with you, so thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you, Scott. Yeah.
Well, it was great to hear that again. It was so kind of John and his wife, Janine, to have us over at their house. And I don't know about you, there was a few little pointers here and there that sort of stood out just listening back to it. One of the fun ones was I enjoyed the discussion about some of the stunts in License to Kill and how they managed to achieve that shot that I've always liked in the film, where this car is sort of shot over an aeroplane and looked incredibly dangerous, and apparently they were using sort of a combination of miniatures and special angles with the photography. That was quite fun. I don't know if there's anything sort of for you, Scott.
Well, I mean, there's nothing like particularly moment wise that stands out, because I think the entire experience for me was just a wonderful couple of hours basically we got to spend with John Glenn and me, his wife, and just be welcomed into that house by him. And I think welcomed is the right word here, because he welcomes fans into the world of James Bond. He clearly cares about James Bond, about the films that he worked on, not just the five he directed, but you know, he edited on some before that as well. He's been part of the family for many years, and he's still an ambassador for James Bond to this day. So I think welcoming is the right word.
Yeah, indeed. And he still holds the record for directing the most James Bond films, and I don't really see that being beaten by anybody. Martin Campbell, Martin Campbell's not even second yet, is he? Because you probably have what, Lewis Gilbert, and who else would you have?
You're putting me on the spot for James Bond knowledge when it's I know some things, but not a lot. Where's my co-host Cam when I need him? He would have all these details for you. I think some of those names are probably out of the running now, just because you know Father Time has been here.
Yes,
but I don't see Sam Mendes coming back for three more, or Martin Campbell.
No, indeed. Well, look, Scott, thank you again for joining me today. One last thing. The reason why I'm sort of putting this out around Christmas is, for me, sort of James Bond movies always remind me of sort of bank holidays and Christmas. And I think one of my earliest Christmas James Bond memories was watching on Her Majesty's Secret Service whilst opening presents in 1989, which was a very long time ago now. I don't know if you have any kind of memories with James Bond and Christmas or bank holidays.
It's not so much tied into Christmas or bank holidays. My earliest James Bond memory is coming out of a screening of Tomorrow Never Dies and sitting in the back of my parents' car and trying to drive it with some sort of implement I found in the back of the car, just thinking I was James Bond. And I was hooked from then on in. So, yeah, wonderful.
Love it. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really cool. I love Tomorrow Never Dies. I think it's a very underrated James Bond film. And yeah, that sequence where he has the mobile phone to control the car, I think fulfills a lot of fantasies for a lot of guys out there.
I think we're all still trying to get that now.
Yeah, indeed. Well, we're getting closer, aren't we? Scott, thank you again for joining me today. Where can listeners sort of find out more about you and your work at Spyhards?
Well, it's a good time to pop on over and check us out. I mean, not only have we spoken to John Glenn in the past as well, and actually focused on Her Majesty's Secret Service, which you mentioned we had a long interview with him a few years ago. But just a couple of weeks ago, we brought out another director, James Bond director interview with Lee Tamahori, the man behind Die Another Day. It's a fascinating conversation, a lot of insight into why that film is what it is. I urge you all to check it out. Yeah, it's a fun one. But you can find us, I mean, for spies, we are terrible at our jobs because you can find us literally everywhere. You just search for Spyhards, any podcast app, you'll find us. Social media, we're all at Spyhards. Just look for us there.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for joining me today.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.